terror. Here is what sometimes happened to me. After spending the first part of the night at my desk, that part when night trudges heavily uphill, I would emerge from the trance of my task at the exact moment when night had reached the summit and was teetering on that crest, ready to roll down into the haze of dawn. I would get up from my chair, feeling chilly and utterly spent, turn on the light in my bedroom, and suddenly see myself in the looking glass. Then it would go like this. During the time I had been deep at work, I had grown disacquainted with myself, a sensation akin to what one may experience when meeting a close friend after years of separation. For a few empty, lucid, but numb moments, you see him in an entirely different light, even though you realize that the frost of this mysterious anesthesia will presently wear off, and the person you are looking at will revive, glow with warmth, resume his old place, becoming again so familiar that no effort of the will could possibly make you recapture that fleeting sensation of estrangedness. Precisely thus I now stood, considering my own reflection in the glass, and failing to recognize it as mine. And the more keenly I examined my face, those unblinking alien eyes, that sheen of tiny hairs along the jaw, that shade along the nose, and the more insistently I told myself, "This is I. This is so-and-so," the less clear it became why this should be I. The harder I found it to make the face in the mirror merge with that I, whose identity I failed to grasp. When I spoke of my odd sensations, people justly observed that the path I had taken led to the madhouse. In point of fact, once or twice late at night I peered so lengthily at my reflection that a creepy feeling came over me, and I put out the light in a hurry. Yet next morning, while shaving, it would never occur to me to question the reality of my image. Another thing. At night, in bed, I would abruptly remember that I was mortal. What then took place within my mind was much the same as happens in a huge theater if the lights suddenly go out, and someone shrilly screams in the swift-winged darkness, and other voices join in, resulting in a blind tempest with the black thunder of panic growing, until suddenly the lights come on again, and the performance of the play is blandly resumed. Thus would my soul choke for a moment, while, lying supine, eyes wide open, I tried with all my might to conquer fear, rationalize death, come to terms with it on a day-by-day basis without appealing to any creed or philosophy. In the end, one tells oneself that death is still far away, that there will be plenty of time to reason everything out, and yet one knows that one never will do it. And again, in the dark, from the cheapest seats in one's private theater, where warm, live thoughts about dear earthly trifles have panicked, there comes a shriek, and presently subsides when one turns over in bed and starts to think of some different matter. I assume that those sensations, the perplexity before the mirror at night or the sudden pang of death's foretaste, are familiar to many, and if I dwell on them, it is only because they contain just a small particle of that supreme terror that I was destined once to experience. Supreme terror. Special terror. I am groping for the exact term, but my store of ready-made words, which in vain I keep trying on, does not contain even one that will fit. I led a happy life. I had a girl. I remember well the torture of our first separation. I had gone on a business trip abroad, and upon my return she met me at the station. I saw her standing on the platform, caged, as it were, in tawny sunlight, a dusty cone of which had just penetrated through the station's glazed vault. Her face kept rhythmically turning to and fro as the train windows slowly glided by to a stop. With her I always felt easy and at rest. Once only. And here again I feel what a clumsy instrument human speech is. Still, I would like to explain. It is really such nonsense, so ephemeral. We are alone in her room. I write while she darns a silk stocking stretched taut over the back of a wooden spoon, her head bent low. One ear, translucently pink, is half concealed by a strand of fair hair, and the small pearls around her neck gleam touchingly, and her tender cheek appears sunken because of the assiduous pout of her lips. All at once, for no reason at all, I become terrified of her presence. This is far more terrifying than the fact that somehow, for a split second, my mind did not register her identity in the dusty sun of the station. I am terrified by there being another person in the room with me. I am terrified by the very notion of another person. No wonder lunatics don't recognize relatives. But she raises her head. All her features participate in the quick smile she gives me, and no trace is left now of the odd terror I felt a moment ago. Let me repeat, this happened only one single time, and I took it to be a silly trick of my nerves. Forgetting that on lonely nights before a lonely mirror, I had experienced something quite similar. She was my mistress for nearly 3 years. I know that many people could not understand our relationship. They were at a loss to explain what there was in that naive little maiden to attract and hold a poet's affection. But, good God, how I loved her unassuming prettiness, gaiety, friendliness, the bird-like flutterings of her soul. It was exactly that gentle simplicity of hers that protected me. To her, everything in the world had a kind of everyday clarity, and it would even seem to me that she knew what awaited us after death, so that there was no reason for us to discuss that topic. At the end of our 3rd year together, I again was obliged to go away for a rather long time. On the eve of my departure, we went to the opera. She sat down for a moment on the crimson little sofa in the darkish, rather mysterious vestibule of our loge to take off her huge gray snow boots, from which I helped her to extricate her slender, silk-clad legs, and I thought of those delicate moths that hatch from bulky, shaggy cocoons. We moved to the front of our box. We were gay as we bent over the rosy abyss of the house while waiting for the raising of the curtain. A solid old screen with pale gold decorations depicting scenes from various operas, Ruslan in his pointed helmet, Lenski in his carrick. With her bare elbow she almost knocked down from the plush parapet her little nacreous opera glass. Then, when all in the audience had taken their seats and the orchestra drew in its breath and prepared to blast forth, something happened. Every light went out in the huge rosy theater. And such a dense darkness swooped upon us that I thought I had gone blind. In this darkness everything at once began to move. A shiver of panic began to rise and resolved itself in feminine cries, and because men's voices very loudly called for calm, the cries became more and more riotous. I laughed and began talking to her, but then felt that she had clutched my wrist and was silently worrying my cuff. When light again filled the house, I saw that she was pale and that her teeth were clenched. I helped her to get out of the loge. She shook her head, chiding herself with a deprecatory smile for her childish fright, but then burst into tears and asked to be taken home. It was only in the close carriage that she regained her composure and, pressing her crumpled handkerchief to her swimming bright eyes, began to explain how sad she felt about my going away tomorrow, and how wrong it would have been to spend our last evening at the opera among strangers. 12 hours later, I was in a train compartment, looking out of the window at the misty winter sky, the inflamed little eye of the sun, which kept up with the train, the white snow-covered fields, which kept endlessly opening up like a giant fan of swan's down. It was in the foreign city I reached the next day that I was to have my encounter with supreme terror. To begin with, I slept badly for 3 nights in a row, and did not sleep at all during the 4th. In recent years I had lost the habit of solitude, and now those solitary nights caused me acute, unrelieved anguish. The first night I saw my girl in a dream. Sunlight flooded her room, and she sat on the bed wearing only a lacy nightgown, and laughed, could not stop laughing. I recalled my dream quite by accident a couple of hours later as I was passing a lingerie store, and upon remembering it realized that all that had been so gay in my dream, her lace, her thrown-back head, her laughter, was now, in my waking state, frightening. Yet I could not explain to myself why that lacy, laughing dream was now so unpleasant, so hideous. I had a lot of things to take care of, and I smoked a lot. And all the time I was aware of the feeling that I absolutely must maintain rigid control over myself. When getting ready for bed in my hotel room, I would deliberately whistle or hum, but would start, like a fearful child, at the slightest noise behind me, such as the flop of my jacket slipping from the chair back to the floor. On the fifth day, after a bad night, I took time out for a stroll. I wish the part of my story to which I am coming now could be set in italics. No, not even italics would do. I need some new, unique kind of type. Insomnia had left me with an exceptionally receptive void within my mind. My head seemed made of glass, and the slight cramp in my calves had also a vitreous character. As soon as I came out of the hotel, yes, now I think I have found the right words. I hasten to write them down before they fade. When I came out on the street, I suddenly saw the world such as it really is. You see, we find comfort in telling ourselves that the world could not exist without us, that it exists only inasmuch as we ourselves exist, inasmuch as we can represent it to ourselves. Death, infinite space, galaxies, all this is frightening, exactly because it transcends the limits of our perception. Well, on that terrible day when, devastated by a sleepless night, I stepped out into the center of an incidental city and saw houses, trees, automobiles, people, my mind abruptly refused to accept them as houses, trees, and so forth, as something connected with ordinary human life. My line of communication with the world snapped. I was on my own, and the world was on its own, and that world was devoid of sense. I saw the actual essence of all things. I looked at houses, and they had lost their usual meaning, that is, all that we think when looking at a house, a certain architectural style, the sort of rooms inside, ugly house, comfortable house, all this had evaporated, leaving nothing but an absurd shell, the same way an absurd sound is left after one has repeated sufficiently long the commonest word without heeding its meaning. House. 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 It was the same with trees, the same with people. I understood the horror of a human face. Anatomy, sexual distinctions, the notion of legs, arms, clothes, all that was abolished, and there remained in front of me a mere something, not even a creature, for that too is a human concept, but merely something moving past. In vain did I try to master my terror by recalling how, once in my childhood, on waking up, I raised my still sleepy eyes while pressing the back of my neck to my low pillow, and saw, leaning toward me over the bedhead, an incomprehensible face. Noseless, with a hussar's black mustache just below its octopus eyes, and with teeth set in its forehead. I sat up with a shriek, and immediately the mustache became eyebrows, and the entire face was transformed into that of my mother, which I had glimpsed at first in an unwonted upside-down aspect. And now, too, I tried to sit up, mentally, so that the visible world might resume its everyday position. But I did not succeed. On the contrary, the closer I peered at people, the more absurd their appearance looked to me. Overwhelmed with terror, I sought support in some basic idea, some better brick than the Cartesian one, with the help of which to begin the reconstruction of the simple, natural, habitual world as we know it. By that time I was resting, I believe, on the bench of a public park. I have no precise recollection of my actions. Just as a man who is having a heart attack on a sidewalk does not give a hoot for the passers-by, the sun, the beauty of an ancient cathedral, and has only one concern, to breathe, so I too had but one desire, not to go mad. I am convinced that nobody ever saw the world the way I saw it during those moments, in all its terrifying nakedness and terrifying absurdity. Near me a dog was sniffing the snow. I was tortured by my efforts to recognize what dog might mean, and because I had been staring at it hard, it crept up to me trustingly, and I felt so nauseated that I got up from the bench and walked away. It was then that my terror reached its highest point. I gave up struggling. I was no longer a man, but a naked eye, an aimless glance moving in an absurd world. The very sight of a human face made me want to scream. Presently, I found myself again at the entrance of my hotel. Someone came up to me, pronounced my name, and thrust a folded slip of paper into my limp hand. Automatically, I unfolded it, and at once my terror vanished. Everything around me became again ordinary and unobtrusive. The hotel, the changing reflections in the glass of the revolving door, the familiar face of the bellboy who had handed me the telegram. I now stood in the middle of the spacious vestibule. A man with a pipe and a checked cap brushed against me in passing and gravely apologized. I felt astonishment and an intense, unbearable, but quite human pain. The telegram said she was dying. While I traveled back, while I sat at her bedside, it never occurred to me to analyze the meaning of being and non-being, and no longer was I terrified by those thoughts. The woman I loved more than anything on earth was dying. This was all I saw or felt. She did not recognize me when my knee thudded against the side of her bed. She lay propped up on huge pillows under huge blankets, herself so small, with hair brushed back from the forehead, revealing the narrow scar on her temple, ordinarily concealed by a strand, brushed low over it. She did not recognize my living presence, but by the slight smile that raised once or twice the corners of her lips, I knew that she saw me in her quiet delirium, in her dying fancy, so that there were two of me standing before her, I myself, whom she did not see, and my double, who was invisible to me. And then I remained alone. My double died with her. Her death saved me from insanity. Plain human grief filled my life so completely that there was no room left for any other emotion. But time flows, and her image within me becomes ever more perfect, ever more lifeless. The details of the past, the live little memories, fade imperceptibly, go out one by one, or in twos and threes, the way lights go out, now here, now there, in the windows of a house where people are falling asleep. And I know that my brain is doomed, that the terror I experienced once, the helpless fear of existing, will sometime overtake me again, and that then there will be no salvation.